Chapter 11. Reframing the Conversation and Arguing to 100. The Seemingly Unstoppable Movement to Eliminate Fossil Fuels. At the beginning of this book, I said, "In this book, I'm going to try to persuade you of something that may seem crazy to you, something that definitely used to seem crazy to me. I'm going to try to persuade you that if you want to make the world a better place, one of the best things you can do is fight for more fossil fuel use, more burning of oil, coal, and natural gas. While we are almost universally told that more fossil fuel use will destroy the world, I am going to make the case that more fossil fuel use will actually make the world a far better place, a place where billions more people will have the opportunity to flourish, including to pull themselves out of poverty, to have a chance to pursue their dreams, and, this will likely seem craziest of all, to experience higher environmental quality and less danger from climate." While all of that may have seemed crazy at the time, I hope it now makes a lot of sense. I hope that the prospect of a flourishing fossil future, achieved through the expansion of energy freedom around the world, inspires you as it does me. And I hope you are motivated to do what you can to fight for that future. However, if you are inspired by the prospect of a fossil future, you might also be feeling two other emotions, fear and helplessness, given that today's world is starting to head in the deadly direction of fossil fuel elimination, and that support for that direction is so overwhelmingly massive. Around the world, with few exceptions, governments are committing to eliminating the use of fossil fuels over the next several decades. In my country, President Joe Biden has made it his goal for the U.S. to have net zero CO2 emissions from electricity by 2035 and from all forms of energy by 2050, with unreliable solar and wind as the primary means of getting there. Fossil fuel elimination is not something that the Biden administration is unique in pursuing. In fact, the U.S. is one of the last of nearly 200 nations to sign the Paris Agreement, which commits these countries to a 0.5 degree to 1 degree Celsius limit on global warming from today, 1.5 degree to 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial times, effectively a net zero commitment. Because the continuing use of uniquely low-cost, on-demand, versatile, global-scale fossil fuel energy is essential to the livability of our world going forward, the policy of fossil fuel elimination would be apocalyptic if implemented fully, and even if just partially implemented, would perpetrate mass suffering and death, not to mention destroy the positive potential for new levels of flourishing. And the support for this deadly direction seems overwhelming, because that support comes from today's mainstream global knowledge system, which reinforces the goal of fossil fuel elimination and the distortions that support it on a daily basis. Take the media. Every day, trusted news institutions tell us that we need to rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use and share news that reinforces the two main distorted narratives used to support that policy. One, fossil fuels are causing catastrophic climate change. Two, fossil fuels are rapidly replaceable by renewables. Depending on what week you are listening to this, there will be fear-inducing stories from trusted sources about unprecedented temperatures, droughts, wildfires, storms, and floods, as well as new studies saying it's going to get a lot worse. At the same time, there will be inspirational stories about how renewables are more than ready to replace fossil fuels if only we have the political will. As bad as the media's constant advocacy of fossil fuel elimination is, the educational system is likely worse. Above all, with respect to creating debilitating, irrational fear of climate apocalypse. Educational systems around the world increasingly make climate change, meaning catastrophic or apocalyptic climate change, a central subject. Two-thirds of U.S. states, include the study of human-caused climate change in their educational standards? What percentage discuss the benefits of fossil fuels, including climate mastery? Surely less than 1%. The result of education about climate catastrophe is a terrified generation. One 2020 survey of Americans found that 71% of millennials and 67% of Generation Z feel climate change has negatively affected their mental health. In Australia, a survey of high school and university students found that 4 out of 5 reported being somewhat or very anxious about climate change. The depth of indoctrination about climate danger, something that is in fact far less of a problem than it has ever been, is captured by one respondent to the survey. "I genuinely have the fear that climate change is going to kill me and all my family. I'm not even kidding. It's all I have thought about for the last 9 months, every second of the day. It's making me sick to my stomach. I'm not eating or sleeping, and I'm getting panic attacks daily. It's currently 1 a.m., and I can't sleep as I'm petrified." A generation terrified of climate change is one primed to vote for fossil fuel outlawing climate solutions that promise to make the fear go away. In addition to the media and educational system's push for fossil fuel elimination, there is an overwhelming and fast-growing corporate push both to advocate for fossil fuel elimination and to enact it through pressure on private companies. In the realm of advocacy, the corporate push for fossil fuel elimination adds massive firepower to the anti-fossil fuel movement because the vast resources and credibility of the world's leading companies are being harnessed to support anti-fossil fuel propaganda and policies. To take just one example of the scale of this, Jeff Bezos, in my view one of the greatest producers to ever live, has pledged $10 billion to fight climate change, money that will overwhelmingly go to green, including anti-nuclear, groups such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the World Wildlife Fund, both of which got initial $100 million grants from Bezos. The aspect of the corporate anti-fossil fuel movement that scares me the most is the ESG movement, which prods companies not only to advocate for fossil fuel elimination, but also to commit to practicing it, independent of what the law says. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. In the realm of environmental, being good means being on a path to rapid fossil fuel elimination. ESG has taken over stock exchanges and financial institutions, which now reward and punish companies based on their ESG standing, which largely means how much they pledge to not use fossil fuels going forward. Shipping companies are rewarded for pledges to somehow not use oil in the future. Digital tech companies are graded on their pledges to somehow use only renewable electricity. Food companies are rewarded for pledges to somehow become carbon neutral. And oil companies are rewarded for pledging to rapidly transform into non-oil companies. ESG not only rewards companies for pledging to get off fossil fuels themselves, but also for supporting anti-fossil fuel policies, and it punishes them if they support fossil fuel freedom policies. Thus, the world's leading corporations are being enlisted as propagandists and lobbyists for fossil fuel elimination. The pervasive, entrenched propagation of fossil fuel elimination by the whole knowledge system, including the media, the educational system, and the corporate world, is so bad that in surveys about climate change, more than half of the respondents in most countries answer that it is very likely or quite likely that climate change will end the human race. All of this makes a free, flourishing fossil future seem out of reach, and a disempowered future seem almost inevitable. By disempowered future, I do not mean that the entire world will eliminate fossil fuels. Because of the fundamental benefits of fossil fuels and their near-term irreplaceability, many countries around the world will not jump off the fossil fuel elimination cliff. China, for example, is building hundreds of coal plants around the world. many of them used to manufacture green solar panels and wind turbines for the U.S. and others to buy. So global fossil fuel elimination is not going to happen. However, our knowledge system's overwhelming push for global fossil fuel elimination will, if not changed, almost certainly lead to a disempowered future in three terrible ways. 1, unilateral disempowerment. 2, incentivized unempowerment. And 3, widespread underempowerment. By unilateral disempowerment, I mean the probability that many empowered places, likely in North America or Europe, significantly eliminate fossil fuel use in the name of fighting climate change, while much of the rest of the world does not do the same. What that means in practice is that some countries will see the cost of energy skyrocket, and with it the cost of everything else. Domestic companies will become less competitive, jobs will become scarcer, and incomes will decline. Economic collapse will become a real possibility. At the same time, electrical grids will become less reliable, thanks to increasing amounts of unreliable electricity, backed up by drastically decreasing amounts of reliable electricity. Under the current Biden administration, the U.S. is a leading candidate for unilateral disempowerment. To the extent some countries unilaterally disempower themselves, other countries will be happy to pick up the slack, just as China has already taken on enormous amounts of U.S. and European industrial production that needed to be outsourced offshore due to the prohibitive costs of green policies. One of my motivations for writing this book is to prevent the U.S. and other free nations from embracing unilateral disempowerment. The nations considering unilateral disempowerment are overwhelmingly the freest nations, while those who will surely not participate, such as China and Russia, are some of the world's biggest oppressors with ambitions of global domination. Thus, I consider unilateral disempowerment by the U.S. to be a truly existential threat for our standard of living and for our security as a nation. The second probability I see is incentivized unempowerment. Incentivized unempowerment is the phenomenon of empowered nations incentivizing unempowered nations to refrain from using fossil fuels and thereby remain unempowered. Often, as I documented in Chapter 10, going by the name of sustainable development. Since many unempowered nations are dictatorships, the dictators involved will be more than willing, in exchange for some sort of payoff, to not increase fossil fuel use, which will inevitably hold back progress, which is what dictatorships do anyway. Incentivized unempowerment is a particularly perverse policy, as it involves righteously depriving countless people of the opportunities that we in the empowered world take for granted. Incentivized unempowerment is also a security threat for the free world, since in the absence of free world support for fossil fuel development, there is an opportunity for China to fill some of the void, as I discussed in the last chapter. The third probability I see is widespread underempowerment. This is the phenomenon, already occurring and likely to get far worse, of incremental restrictions and bans on fossil fuel freedom and energy freedom more broadly, making energy more expensive, less reliable, and less versatile for billions of people. Because energy is the industry that powers every other industry, widespread underempowerment will prevent flourishing and progress on a global scale. All these phenomena together, unilateral disempowerment, incentivized unempowerment, and widespread underempowerment, will harm every person in the world, with the poorest people hurt most of all. That's where the global knowledge system's push for fossil fuel elimination is taking us. But it doesn't have to be this way. Why I'm optimistic. Before I make things better, let me make them worse. All this anti-fossil fuel momentum is taking place despite decades of attempts by the wealthy and powerful fossil fuel industry and its political allies to fight against fossil fuel elimination policies. the fossil fuel industry is widely considered a hugely influential industry. This is plausible because it is one of the largest industries in the world and has made a lot of money and attracted very capable people, including people with significant political connections. But while the fossil fuel industry has massive resources and capabilities and is incentivized to oppose the fossil fuel elimination movement and has tried for decades to do so, it has failed, as have its widespread political allies, which in the United States include much of the Republican Party. If the mighty fossil fuel industry and its allies can't do anything about the overwhelming fossil fuel elimination movement, is there anything you as an individual can do? My answer, absolutely you can. And if you have found this book's case for a fossil future persuasive, where other arguments weren't, you have evidence of that fact. This book and the rest of my advocacy of fossil fuels employ a different and far more effective approach to persuasion on this issue than traditional supporters of fossil fuels have employed, an approach I call reframing the conversation and arguing to 100. If enough of us take this approach, we can absolutely reverse the anti-fossil fuel trend and help bring about a flourishing fossil future. The root of my confidence that it is possible to fight successfully for a flourishing fossil future is my own experience, supplemented by observing the success of others who are deviating from traditional approaches in similar ways. The approach I've taken to arguing for fossil fuels and energy freedom has proven time and again to convince people who have been unconvinced by everything the fossil fuel industry and other traditional supporters of fossil fuels have said combined. I've gotten countless notes like the following. If you had told 18-year-old me that 4 years later I would be praising a book called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, I probably would have thought you were crazy. At the time, I was a capital P progressive environmentalist. Yet here I am at 22, blown away by a book that posits that fossil fuels are the lifeblood of modern existence. The persuasiveness of my approach is what has enabled me, despite starting out as an obscure person with virtually zero financial resources, to write one of the best-selling and most influential energy books of the last decade, create videos advocating for fossil fuels that have been viewed by tens of millions of people, advise over 100 congressional offices on how to persuasively advocate for energy freedom, and speak at elite institutions that most wouldn't expect to be open to fossil fuel advocacy, from leading universities, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, to Google. Furthering my confidence in my approach, I've seen others who have taken a similar approach, such as Michael Schellenberger, Bjorn Lomborg, and Robert Bryce, also achieve mass influence that dwarfs that of the fossil fuel industry's well-funded but largely ineffectual, and I will argue often counterproductive, efforts. I believe that the approach I've taken can be used highly effectively, not just by full-time writers and experts, but even by those without much time to devote to study and persuasion. Specifically, I believe the approach I have taken, reframing the conversation and arguing to 100, can be highly effective for you. It doesn't require a lot of time, but what it does require is understanding why the fossil fuel elimination movement is so successful, why the conventional approach to advocating for fossil fuels fails, and what makes my approach different. The key to the anti-fossil fuel movement's success: framing the conversation and arguing to 100. To understand why traditional approaches to advocating fossil fuels fail, and to understand what new approaches are most likely to succeed, we need to understand why today's anti-fossil fuel movement has become so successful. In this book, I have discussed at length the basic reason for this. Advocates of eliminating human impact have established the anti-impact framework as our knowledge system's dominant framework, which inevitably leads to support for eliminating our most important and therefore most impacting of nature source of cost-effective energy, fossil fuels. But to counter the fossil fuel elimination movement it's valuable to understand with more specificity how it drives policy. I've coined the phrase arguing to 100 to capture how fossil fuel elimination is advanced and, more broadly, how most, if not all, policy-changing movements advance their policies. Arguing to 100 is the practice of 1. Establishing the moral goal around which a particular cultural conversation is framed, then 2. Arguing that one's particular policies are the most effective way to achieve it. Every argument to 100 includes 3 elements. A 100, a moral goal one wants to move toward. A negative 100, a moral evil one wants to move away from. 3. A policy or policies to move toward 100 and away from negative 100. A classic example of arguing to 100 is Martin Luther King Jr.'s arguments for policy reform on issues of racial discrimination in the 1960s. King's famous dream of a society in which individuals would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character was an inspiring moral goal, a 100. The opposite, a society in which individuals were judged not by the content of their character, but by the color of their skin, was a negative 100. By arguing that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and related policies would move us toward 100, judging individuals by the content of their character, and away from negative 100, judging individuals by the color of their skin, King was enormously effective at advancing those policies. Often and powerfully, arguing to 100 involves reframing the existing 100 and negative 100 of a conversation. For example, I think Steve Jobs successfully reframed the conversation around computing in the 1970s and 80s. Prior to Jobs, most of the conversation was based on technical performance, regardless of user experience. Jobs called this talking about speeds and feeds. In that conversation, 100 meant high technical performance, and negative 100 meant low technical performance. But for Jobs, the goal, the 100, was empowering all individuals through easy-to-use and powerful computing, whereas negative 100 was computing that was unusable by most people, whether or not it was technically powerful. By reframing the conversation, changing 100 and negative 100, Jobs could effectively argue to 100 for Macs and other Apple devices in contrast to competitors. A recent example of reframing the conversation and arguing to 100 involving a very controversial topic, which I am neither endorsing nor condemning by including it here, was what Donald Trump did to the conversation about America's future in 2016. Prior to Trump's candidacy, the dominant framing of the conversation around America's future was centered around economic equality, with a more equal society being 100 and greater economic inequality being negative 100. Instead of arguing for his policies within this framing, Trump instead reframed 100 and negative 100 based on the issue of America's greatness. For Trump, 100 was American greatness, and negative 100 was American decline. Trump's most famous campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again," was an argument to 100 for his policy agenda, that it would bring us toward 100. Trump consistently argued to 100 for most of his particular policies. Whether the issue was immigration, foreign policy, healthcare, or the economy, he argued that his policy would lead to American greatness. Now that we understand the mechanics of reframing the conversation and arguing to 100, we can see how effectively the anti-impact movement has done this on the issue of fossil fuels. Starting in the 1970s, the anti-impact movement gradually reframed the energy conversation away from a 100 and negative 100 centered on energy's cost and security, both big issues in a decade when Middle Eastern supply threats and gasoline shortages were highly disruptive. Today's energy conversation isn't even really an energy conversation, but rather a conversation about climate impact, where the 100 is eliminating CO2 emissions and the negative 100 is increasing CO2 emissions. As I discussed in Chapter 3, the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, whether under the label of stopping climate change, net zero, carbon neutral, or 100% renewable, is literally the number one moral goal in the world today in policy discussions. Having successfully framed the energy conversation around the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, the anti-impact movement, which has overtaken our knowledge system, argues for an endless onslaught of anti-fossil fuel policies, from a Green New Deal, to a carbon tax, to a moratorium on new drilling, to a new solar and wind mandate, as a means of getting us toward the 100 of eliminating CO2 emissions and away from the negative 100 of rising CO2 emissions. A helpful metaphor for the relationship between the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions and today's overwhelming onslaught of anti-fossil fuel policies is the Hydra. The Hydra is the multi-headed creature from Greek mythology that could not be defeated by chopping off individual heads sequentially, because more heads would grow back. The heart of the Hydra had to be destroyed. The heart of the anti-fossil fuel Hydra is its moral goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, and myriad anti-fossil fuel policies are its heads. The moral goal of eliminating CO2 emissions is itself a head of another Hydra, the anti-impact framework. As I've discussed in this book at length, the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions does not get adopted in isolation. It depends on the whole anti-impact framework, including the deeper moral goal of eliminating human impact, often disguised with vague environmental terminology, saving the planet, protecting the environment, and the delicate nurturer assumption. The goal of eliminating CO2 emissions also depends on specific distortions driven by the anti-impact framework, namely, 1. CO2 emissions are causing climate apocalypse. 2. The value we get from fossil fuels today is trivial compared to its negative side effects. 3. Any value we do get from fossil fuels can be rapidly replaced by renewables. To summarize, today's highly successful push for fossil fuel elimination policies depends on the moral goal, 100, of eliminating human impact, the anti-impact framework that supports it, and specific distortions based on that framework. Given this, it stands to reason that the only way to reverse course is to reframe the conversation and argue to 100. Challenge and change the moral goal, including the anti-impact framework and specific distortions it is based on, then argue for growing fossil fuel use under a policy of energy freedom based on the new moral goal. Instead, what most advocates of fossil fuels have done is what I call arguing to zero. Fossil fuel advocates' mistake: arguing to zero. Arguing to zero is the practice of conceding the moral goal of one's opponent, but then challenging as impractical their particular policies to achieve that goal. This perfectly describes the approach of most traditional supporters of fossil fuels. Fossil fuel supporters generally concede the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, whether under the name stopping climate change, net zero, or carbon neutral, in two ways: explicit and implicit. Sometimes, and increasingly, the concession is an explicit endorsement of that goal. For example, international oil giants Shell and BP have both committed themselves to becoming carbon neutral by 2050. More and more fossil fuel-based companies are signing their names to carbon neutral pledges and policy statements. All of these are misleading, and none are possible for the reasons I gave in Chapter 6. Even when companies don't explicitly concede the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, they usually concede it implicitly by not challenging it. When the world's number one moral goal calls for the elimination of your industry, to not challenge it is to concede it. In addition to conceding the moral goal of CO2 elimination, and therefore the elimination of fossil fuels, fossil fuel supporters frequently concede and therefore reinforce the key elements of the anti-impact framework that supports the moral goal of CO2 elimination. Fossil fuel supporters frequently endorse the disguised goal of eliminating human impact by saying they want to minimize our environmental impact, not drawing the distinction between productive and destructive environmental impact, even though impacting our environment in a productive way is the core of what fossil fuels do. Fossil fuel supporters routinely affirm the delicate nurture assumption by including references to sensitive ecosystems. Finally, fossil fuel supporters, including fossil fuel companies, frequently concede the framework-driven distortions used to support the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions. The most important concession here is of the idea of climate catastrophe or apocalypse, a concession many supporters make either by using catastrophic language, for example, climate change is an existential threat, or more frequently, by using language that doesn't say climate change is a catastrophe, but says it's a crucial problem and doesn't challenge the catastrophe narrative. For example, climate change is real, climate change is a serious threat. It is also a concession of climate catastrophe to not discuss the issue, which was historically the dominant response of the fossil fuel industry. I remember, before I started studying energy, finding the policy of non-engagement with climate catastrophe claims very unpersuasive. It simply reinforced to me that climate catastrophe was a serious problem. The fossil fuel industry's concession on the climate issue show how deeply it accepts the anti-impact framework. On the human flourishing framework, the fossil fuel industry would be proudly proclaiming its contribution to climate mastery and the unprecedented safety from climate it has brought about. But on the anti-impact framework, the only climate role of industry can be negative, so it either apologizes or ducks the issue. The fossil fuel industry's failure to celebrate its climate mastery is part of a second failure that reinforces the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions: the failure to proclaim the fundamental benefits of fossil fuel energy to human flourishing, which, as I have discussed at length in this book, are so significant that they literally make our entire world far more livable. In recent years, the fossil fuel industry has done more to talk about the value of what it does, but still nothing close to what is necessary to counter our knowledge system's pervasive fossil fuel benefit denial. As long as the public remains clueless about the fundamental and unique benefits of fossil fuels, eliminating CO2 emissions will seem like a low-cost or even costless goal. Increasingly, the fossil fuel industry makes a third concession to the framework-driven distortions that support the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions: the renewables can replace fossil fuels distortion. Often this is implicit, such as when fossil fuel companies showcase their trivial renewable operations or refuse to say anything about the superiority of fossil fuels, or when pro-fossil fuel politicians say they are for all of the above on energy with no suggestion that there's anything superior about fossil fuels. But conceding the renewables can replace fossil fuels distortion is becoming more and more explicit, particularly by companies that have outright conceded emissions elimination targets. For example, a well-funded BP advertisement portrays the Midwest as constantly windy, providing ample fuel for wind turbines, and portrays natural gas as a rarely needed backup, when in reality, it is essential life support, and the wind turbines are wasteful add-ons. It's hard to imagine anything more reinforcing of the renewables can replace fossil fuels distortion than leading fossil fuel companies spreading renewables propaganda. Having conceded the moral goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, the anti-impact framework on which it is based, and often many of the framework-driven distortions supporting that goal, supporters of fossil fuels have rolled out the red carpet for unlimited arguments to 100 in favor of fossil fuel elimination policies. And that's exactly what they have gotten. Having reinforced the cause of anti-fossil fuel policies, fossil fuel supporters traditionally fight vigorously against each individual policy, finding some particular fault with it. Cap and trade and the Green New Deal are too expensive. a leasing ban costs jobs. Shutting down a coal mine hurts a particular community. This is classic arguing to zero. I agree with your goal, but this particular way of achieving it is impractical. To return to the Hydra metaphor, fossil fuel supporters are treating the fossil fuel elimination Hydra not as a Hydra, but as a series of individual cobras that can be dealt with sequentially. But since these attacks are united by a root cause that arguing to zero doesn't stop and in fact reinforces, fossil fuel supporters are actually pumping blood into the heart of the Hydra. And thus, the Hydra's heads keep multiplying. To be sure, fossil fuel supporters have won many specific battles by arguing to zero against many specific Hydra heads. But the war keeps going in the direction of fossil fuel elimination. And over time, the war has gotten harder and harder for advocates of fossil fuels to fight, with accelerating victories for the anti-fossil fuel side. The reason is that the more the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions, the anti-impact framework, and specific distortions are reinforced by arguing to zero, the more dramatic the case for action seems to the general public, and the less defensible fossil fuel supporters' opposition to every particular proposed action. The overall position of those arguing to zero, sometimes explicit and sometimes implicit, is that fossil fuels are a temporarily necessary evil. Yes, we want to eliminate them, primarily because of their CO2 emissions, but it's not practical to eliminate them soon. But this position never makes sense, because if something is truly evil on the level of destroying the world, then it can't really be necessary. And the more that climate catastrophe is conceded, the more that the triviality of fossil fuels' value is conceded, and the more fossil fuels' replaceability by renewables is conceded, the less necessary the evil seems to be. The obvious conclusion is that fossil fuel supporters are just deniers and delayers, denying the full evil of fossil fuels and delaying policies that would make things better. Arguing to zero doesn't work, except in favor of those who want to eliminate fossil fuels. Which raises the question, why is it so common among supporters of fossil fuels? I think there are three reasons for arguing to zero. One is that most supporters of fossil fuels are substantially on the anti-impact framework themselves. And the younger they are, the more they tend to be on it. When you substantially agree with the existing framework, it's unlikely you'll do the reframing necessary to argue to 100. The second is that most supporters of fossil fuels have limited awareness of how powerful one's philosophical framework is. Philosophy is widely regarded as an impractical subject that people in practical fields like business and politics need not concern themselves with. This book has addressed the preceding reasons many times over. But there is a third reason for arguing to zero that requires a clear refutation: the idea that it's extremely difficult to change the philosophical framework of an audience, so reframing and arguing to 100 is impossible, and the best one can hope to do is argue to zero. This argument is plausible, but fortunately turns out to be completely wrong. My experience has demonstrated that reframing is not only possible, but surprisingly easy. Is reframing actually possible? It should be clear by now that reframing the energy conversation away from the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions and the anti-impact framework it is based on, and toward the goal of advancing human flourishing and the rest of the human flourishing framework, would be a very good thing that would make it possible to argue to 100 for more fossil fuel use. But this raises the question: to what extent is it possible to reframe the conversation? Many communications experts say that challenging the basic framework of a conversation, when very widespread ideas are involved, is not doable and is in fact counterproductive. And this is plausible, because when a framework is deeply entrenched enough, making an argument on a specific issue that challenges that framework is usually bound to fail. consider the truism that it's a bad idea to try to convince people on issues of religion, a big part of many people's operating framework that is usually very hard to change. For example, if a political candidate is trying to persuade a group of Catholics of an economic policy, he won't say, "My policy totally contradicts Catholicism, so you should reject Catholicism and adopt my policy." He'll try to find a way to make his position consistent with Catholicism. The same basic argument could be made about people's framework on energy. People believe in the goal of eliminating CO2 emissions and, more broadly, saving the planet. And they believe that the Earth is a delicate nurturer. So let's just accept those ideas and try to work with them by arguing against specific anti-fossil fuel policies on grounds that don't involve challenging the framework that is driving them. Let's talk about jobs or taxpayer money or industry's charitable contributions or the stupidity of a particular policy instead. In other words, let's argue to zero. Again, this approach is plausible because it's true that certain entrenched ideas can be very hard to change, and therefore certain conversations are very hard to reframe. I myself for a long time believed that reframing the conversation on fossil fuels was inordinately difficult. I personally had arrived at the moral case for a fossil future because of the human flourishing framework I was operating on, but I did not know how effective it could be to use that framework in my persuasive efforts. I began suspecting that reframing the conversation was easier than I had thought in the aftermath of my book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, which briefly introduced the book's framework in the first chapter. At the time, I thought that this framing would be valuable, but I had no idea just how valuable it was until I got feedback from readers of the book, over and over, that singled out the book's framework. The feedback from people who considered themselves liberals or environmentalists was particularly revealing in this regard. For example, one reader wrote to me, "I am a lifelong Democrat and a strong Obama supporter. I especially liked the way you framed the issues, using an identified standard, human life and prosperity, a consideration of both the risks and benefits of fossil fuels and their alternatives." In addition to the written feedback on the book reinforcing the value of framing, my experiences speaking about the book really drove the point home. In my hundreds of speeches about the book, I would experiment with different amounts of reframing the conversation from the anti-impact framework to the human flourishing framework. And I found that the more I did, the better results I got. What I realized was that reframing the conversation is not always extremely difficult. It is extremely difficult only when the ideas of the operating framework are truly entrenched, including 1, being embraced explicitly in people's minds, and 2, being a major source of identity for people. In other cases, and fortunately in the case of the anti-impact framework, many people are operating on a framework they have never explicitly thought through and that is not a major source of identity, and where the alternative has never been made explicit. When a framework is held implicitly, without significant investment of identity, and without knowledge of the alternative, it can often be challenged and changed rather easily. I have found that this is the case for many, many people when it comes to challenging the anti-impact framework and replacing it with the human flourishing framework.